Indeed, indeed. But David, I mean, tell us about this Charles Wolfson Charitable Trust. I mean, it's not very left-wing, is it?
It's not very left-wing, no. I mean, it funds a whole series of Zionist organisations in occupied Palestine, including organisations which are engaged in fostering settlements and supporting the IDF. But amongst the organisations it funds and has funded, continued to fund since Mendelssohn joined as a trustee, have been Islamophobic think tanks, in particular the Policy Exchange, one of the leading Islamophobic think tanks in this country. And so there you have, and Tony was saying, the contradiction that this is a guy who comes from the Labour Zionist tradition and supports apparently leftish or critical human rights organisations in Israel. At the same time, he is supporting organisations which are furthering the occupation and indeed pursuing and promoting Islamophobia in this country. So there is the contradiction, and there's an indication that really, in the end, there's a whole range of different sorts of Zionist organisations which can be supported by someone who has politics which are notionally somewhere in the centre.
Tony, what if I asked you about Facebook? I mean, it appears to be a collaborator, doesn't it, Facebook, closely indeed with various Zionist lobby groups. I mean, to what extent do you think this is due to the Zionist politics of senior staff at Facebook, like Nicola Mendelssohn? And how is it, do you think, in Facebook's interests as a US-based profit-making corporation to, you know, be going down this road?
Well, it's essential for Facebook, if it's to continue, that it reflects the imperatives of US imperialism and American foreign policy. And that is the context of its support for Israel and Zionism. It's not so much that particular Zionists are in senior roles, like Nick Clegg, for instance, who is their, I think, social affairs manager, but that Facebook is not going to go against the US government interest, because otherwise it will be subject to regulation. As it is, Mark Zuckerberg has been grilled by various Senate and House committees, so they're not going to stand out. You know, free speech will go by the way, obviously, and that means support for Palestine and anti-Zionism will be particularly monitored and controlled. The same in Israel. I mean, Palestinians get shut down all the time.
Yes.
But if you declare that death to the Arabs as part of your moniker, that will go by the board without any problem whatsoever.
So, I mean, Facebook clearly then, you know, is far from being a sort of independent entity. It's like an arm of the US state and the Israeli state.
It's at one stage removed. It works very, very closely with the Israeli government.
Sure.
What Facebook should be is like your telephone company, a platform for you to do whatever
Indeed.
You want.
Indeed.
It shouldn't have any interference in your content.
No, no.
But, of course, the media companies would not like that one bit. I mean, media in the Western world is propaganda. So the social media companies have to be reined in.
Absolutely. Well, we're just going to have to pause there for a moment, because we've got another report now about an apparent radical publisher that's actually controlled by Lord John Mendelssohn himself.
Zionists often complain that we at Palestine Declassified don't distinguish enough between the differing strands of Zionism, flattening out the distinctions, they say. So let's look at a radical publisher called No Pasaran Media. It has a tagline, publishing left activists resisting left anti-Semitism. It is named after the slogan made famous in the heroic resistance to fascism in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. No Pasaran, they shall not pass. And at first glance, the books seem radical. Among them are Confronting Anti-Semitism on the Left, Arguments for Socialist by Daniel Randall, Outcast, How Jews Were Banished from the Anti-Racist Imagination by Camilla Bassi, That's Funny You Don't Look Anti-Semitic by Steve Cohen. First published in 1984, the book by Cohen looked at so-called left anti-Semitism from a Marxist perspective. This is surely radical stuff. In reality, of course, the books are not radical, but are uniformly attempting to give a left face to apologism for ethnic cleansing in Palestine. Randall's book does this by arguing that Zionism is just a nationalist movement and not a matter of the settler colonialism it so evidently is. The book by Bassi tries to claim that anti-Semitism has banished Jews from the anti-racist imagination, but she provides no evidence that there is a serious problem of racism facing Jews in the West today. Both Randall and Bassi toss about the Islamophobic term Islamist, one indication of the racism at the heart of their analysis. Cohen, notionally at the time an anti-Zionist, sat down to write a book on Israel's brutal invasion of Lebanon in 1982, full of condemnation of the aggressors, in which 18,000 people were killed. But he got up having finished the book on the obviously less important topic of left-wing anti-Semitism, in which no people were killed. The book was pounced upon by Zionists. It was republished by the Zionist group Engage in 2005 and by No Passeran in 2019. All three authors, though they identify as Marxists, are actually apologists for Zionist racism. The first two are supporters of the tiny cult-like pro-Zionist sect, the Alliance for Workers' Liberty. The third, Steve Cohen, reportedly ended up a supporter of AWL before he died in 2009. Surely a publisher called No Passeran must also be associated with left-wing groups, thus indicating that there is indeed a variety of right and left-wing Zionism. Actually, no. The company has a single director, none other than Uber lobbyist and Zionist normalizer Lord John Mendelson. Differences between Zionists on how many or how fast the Palestinians should be ethnically cleansed are to some extent a matter of marketing strategy.
Tony, you were part of the debates, weren't you, on Zionism around the feminist magazine Spare Rib in the 1980s that led to this Steve Cohen book being published. I wonder whether you could just fill us in on how all that came about.
Well, I mean, Steve Cohen wrote this book at a particular time. He was undergoing, if you like, a certain political evolution. But yeah. Steve Cohen was a friend of mine. We worked very closely on anti-racist campaigns, etc. And by the end of his life, because it was cut short because he had polio, he really had very little to do with the book. He didn't even stand by it. And he told me, really, our last conversation before he died, that he'd been pressurised to let Engage take it over, but he wasn't very happy with it and how they were using it. And at his memorial meeting, when Engage put his book on every seat, I spoke and I said that Steve Cohen was not a Zionist.
No.
He had condemned Israel as a racist state because he said a Jewish state was inevitably a racist state, which is absolutely correct.
Mm.
And half the audience walked out. It was a meeting in Manchester.
Really?
So, yeah. Yes, I mean, they borrowed his name because he had a record as an anti-racist immigration lawyer.
Yeah.
People who are racist have used his name, like John Mann, someone who's known as a bigot on just about every count, anti-Gypsy, anti-Roma, etc. So, no, I mean, Steve Cohen was a socialist, and he was first and foremost a committed anti-racist campaigner, and so they've really taken his name in vain. And because he's dead, of course, he can't respond to them.
Of course.
But he'd be the first to object, to be quite honest.
Yeah. I mean, David, I mean, as we heard in the film there, this publisher uses the phrase No Passeran in its title, which is somewhat misleading, isn't it?
Well, it's a disgrace, really, to the memory of the people who heroically fought the fascists in Spain between 1936 and 1939. It's an anti-fascist slogan which should not be taken in vain. Should not be taken in order to effectively whitewash the record of the Zionist movement, which is not in fighting fascism. Indeed, it's, in some ways, it's been just the opposite.
Yeah.
So I think it's very sad that they are able to get away with that, and that no one really calls them out on that. They even have the upside down exclamation marks, which you have in Spanish, to emphasise an exclamation, which really is terrible. I mean, the history and the memory of the people who fought from this country in the International Brigade should not be sullied by tainting with Zionism.
No, absolutely. Well, Tony, I mean, look, you know, you've debated with this character, Daniel Randall, more than once, haven't you? I mean, tell us about the arguments that you had with him.
Well, I mean, it's really difficult to say. I mean, his argument is that Zionism is some form of genuine national liberation movement of Jews. And, I mean, I pointed out to him that when Zionism came on the scene, most Jews saw Zionism as a form of Jewish anti-Semitism because the anti-Semites wanted the Jews to get out and the Zionists wanted them to get out because the whole basis of Zionism is that Jews do not belong in the societies where they live. Mm. The Alliance for Workers' Liberty, which is Daniel Randall's organisation, is a pro-Zionist, pro-imperialist party. Yeah. I mean, it supported the occupation of Iraq by American and NATO troops, for example. It's not a left-wing group in any real or meaningful sense. I mean, it borrows the terminology of the left, but in The Witch Hunt, it stood side by side with Luke Akehurst, who, as soon as they got rid of us, they got rid of them.
Luke Akehurst being a very prominent right-wing witch hunter who's on the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party. But David, I mean, as you saw in the film there, these Marxist books trade in Islamophobic terms like Islamists, don't they? I mean, why do you think that is? It's odd, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I think it's Islamophobia is fundamental to Zionism. It's not just that they've got to justify kicking the Palestinians out, they've got to say that the people that they oppose, who are Muslim in the main, are backward, civilizationally not quite the way in which white Europeans would want to be. And so that's a fundamental. But the specific term Islamist doesn't exist until around about 1979, 1980. And it comes into public use and is promoted especially by Zionist ideologues. Also, to some extent, by academics who have a relationship with the CIA, so who'd studied Afghanistan, for example, or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. But primarily, it's coined by Zionist intellectuals, and they then promote it as a term in the context of also promoting terms like Islamic terrorism, as if there is some kind of terrorism which is specifically Islamic. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it's like blending together all different currents of Islamic thought which have an influence and bearing on politics, as if they're the same. And you wouldn't unite, for example, the civil rights movement in the US, liberation theology in Latin America, and the Orange Order and loyalist movement in Northern Ireland under the one terminology of Christianist, would you? And of course, to get on top of that, there's the additional thing of the racialization of Muslims, which has come since 9/11, which makes it a racist term, and it should have no place in leftist discourse, in my view.
Just return, Tony, to the Alliance for Workers' Liberty that we were just touching on there. I mean, it's often referred to as a kind of cult-like body. I mean, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I think that's that is accurate. It's led by a so-called guru, Sean McGamner, who became a Zionist and was convinced that Israel was the recompense for what happened during the Holocaust, and the fact that the Palestinians paid the price for it is, in his eyes, irrelevant. But in many ways, I mean, you could say the same about apartheid in South Africa. The Afrikaners also fled oppression and also suffered in concentration camps. Did that therefore justify apartheid? No, it's a nonsense. The group is not a Marxist group. It's not a left-wing group either. It's very much like Antifa in Germany. It claims to be left but acts on the right, often in conjunction with the state. And I wouldn't be surprised if the AWL receives state funding indirectly.
No, indeed. Well, briefly and finally, David, I mean, overall, it's rather incongruous, isn't it, for so-called centrist Zionists to work with apparently left-wing groups, as well as those who were quite on the far right of the political spectrum. And briefly, it is incongruous, isn't it?
Well, as Tony's been saying, it's a contradiction, right? But it's also interesting, isn't it? Because we started off this programme by talking about the accusations against us of flattening out the differences between Zionists, different sorts of Zionists. And, of course, there are differences between different sorts of Zionists, and they do fight each other to some extent. But in the one person of John Mendelsohn, you have support for almost the full range of Zionist factions. So what you're seeing here is that actually, you know, this is not difficult. Zionists are Zionists because they actually are Zionists.
Yes.
I mean, the contradiction is not a contradiction. They're actually at root Zionists.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there because, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Tony Greenson, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next week, when Palestine Declassified will be back with more forensic investigations and analysis, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now. We'll be right back.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Press TV, which announced its arrival around 16 years ago as a counterweight to Western propagandist media to demolish its flawed narratives and grossly unfair coverage of Iran and the region, has to a great extent been successful. Now Australia, which has a deeply flawed human rights record, has already slapped three packages of sanctions against Iran since December 2022. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, draconian laws barring the right to peaceful protest, Guantanamo-style abuse of child prisoners, discrimination against First Nations peoples, horrendous abuse of asylum seekers. Still, Australia has the audacity to pour scorn on Iran's human rights record and impose financial sanctions and travel bans on individuals and entities under the smokescreen of human rights. Recently, Anthony Albanese government in Australia imposed targeted financial sanctions and travel bans on four Iranian individuals and three entities, accusing them of oppression of people in Iran, including women and girls. Australia has already slapped three packages of sanctions against Iran since December 2022, but this is the first time it imposed targeted financial sanctions and travel bans under the so-called Iran Autonomous Sanctions Framework. Under the new package, those designated include a spokesman for Iran's law enforcement forces, Iran's cyber police, and Press TV, the Islamic Republic's leading international media network. Press TV is no stranger to sanctions and other heavy-handed measures aimed at muzzling free speech and media freedom. The network and its office bearers have faced a blizzard of sanctions since last year on various flimsy pretexts. In November 2022, U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, imposed sanctions on the network and its parent organization, IRIB, on the baseless pretext of forced confessions of Iranian dual national and international detainees. The same month, the European Union also quite hysterically jumped the bandwagon and imposed a slew of sanctions on Iranian individuals and entities, including Press TV, with the same ruse: forced confessions of detainees that is actually baseless. In December last year, European satellite operator Eutelsat also called on broadcasters to stop airing Press TV over alleged and baseless forced confessions. Press TV, which announced its arrival around 16 years ago as a counterweight to Western propagandist media to demolish its flawed narratives and grossly unfair coverage of Iran and the region, has to a great extent been successful. The network has over the years spoken not only for the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has been at the forefront of the global fight against Western hegemony, but has also told the untold stories of those who have been consigned to oblivion. That is the primary function of free, independent, and vibrant media: to uphold the truth, prevent the manipulation of facts, unmask the hegemons, and speak for the oppressed, weak, and vulnerable. It has been a thorny path, though. Press TV has faced a barrage of sanctions. It has been taken off from satellites. Its social media pages have been suspended or deleted. Its web domains have been seized, and its office bearers have been slapped with financial sanctions and travel bans. No one has spoken in its defense, not even those Western free speech advocates who are never tired of harping about the role of media as the purveyor of truth, disseminator of information, custodian of people's interests, and the forum of political debate. Now, Australia has also joined this notorious league, the country with a deeply flawed human rights record, known for Guantanamo-style abuse of child prisoners. The list of rights abuses in Australia is too long and widely documented. Barely a few months ago, there was news about a 13-year-old Indigenous Australian boy who spent 45 days in solitary confinement on trivial offences. In April, a new damning study by the Immigrant Service at the Royal Children's Hospital, Melbourne, revealed that children held in Australia's immigration detention centres in the past decade have reported alarmingly high rates of mental health problems. In November last year, the UN blasted the Australian government for lack of cooperation and open breach of human rights obligations after a team of UN inspectors had to cancel a tour of detention centres where abuse and death of Aboriginals had previously been reported. These are just a few isolated cases that bear powerful testimony to how the Australian authorities have over the years abused human rights with impunity and gotten away with it. Only on rare occasions has it been reprimanded, like in January 2021, when more than 30 countries at the UN Human Rights Session blasted the country over its horrendous border policies and child detentions that breach international law. The issue of offshore processing of refugees and asylum seekers in particular has been indicative of Australia's lack of compliance with international humanitarian law. The policy has harmed tens of thousands of vulnerable asylum seekers, with many committing suicides at infamous processing camps in Nauru and Papua New Guinea. Taking all this into consideration, Australia has no moral high ground to lecture Iran on human rights and to impose sanctions on a news network that speaks for those harmed by Western regimes.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. Allah. humanity.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. This is Hussein Latifi and you're listening to the program for humanity from IRIB English Radio. In the following episodes, inshallah, we're going to cover some of the concepts and teachings of the Holy Quran regarding human being and humanity. And I hope, inshallah, that by covering these teachings, we can be prepared for applying them in our lives and getting closer to the perfection and destination that Quran has for us, and also Islam has designated for humanity in large. Now, one thing that I think is important to keep in mind when we discuss the concepts and teachings of the Holy Quran about humanity and mankind is to keep a balanced approach and moderate perspective on these concepts, because some of these concepts are negative, some of them positive, and I've seen people that fall into one side of the discussion, only focusing on the negative discussions, some people focusing only on the positive discussions. But I think it's crucial that we keep a balanced approach and consider all of these teachings together, because there's a reason that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala have listed these concepts or these qualities and traits and descriptions for mankind in his book. Now, if you search the word al-insan in the Holy Quran, approximately, I think, 56 times the word al-insan is used in the Holy Quran. Not to say that the discussions and descriptions of humanity only occur with this reference. No, in other verses, sometimes when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Ya ayyuhan nas, O people, or when He addresses humanity by the title Ya Bani Adam, the children of Adam, or sometimes even without any direct reference, but we know that He's talking about humanity at large, like when He tells the story of the creation of Adam alayhi salam. So in all of these, when we put them together, we realize that in some of these discussions, human being and mankind has been placed in a very high rank and high position, like the vicegerency of God on earth, beginning of the Holy Quran, like the second chapter of the Holy Quran, when Allah tells the story of the creation of Adam. Famously, you all know that Prophet Adam has been placed in the position that is unmatched, and no one else in the whole creation has that position, and that is the vicegerency of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on earth, which is very important, and it raised the astonishment of the angels, and you all know the story. And also other verses that praise mankind, like وَلَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ, and other verses that talk about some specific things that only mankind was capable of doing, like the verse of Amana, that Inna aradna al-Amana, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, we exposed or we offered Amana to the whole creation, and nobody accepted that, but man accepted that Amana to be the one carrying out that Amana, and that is a unique thing for humanity. But again, as I said, if you search the word al-insan, almost all cases that insan is mentioned in the Holy Quran, you find it associated with some sort of negative description, like خلق الإنسان عجولا or كفورا or something like that, or من عجل, or many things that hint to some negative sides about this being. And we should see why is that, why these negative traits and qualities have been counted for insan. Inshallah, after a break, we come back and we discuss about the wisdom and philosophy behind those negative descriptions.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, welcome back. This is Hossein Latifi. You're listening to For Humanity program from IRIB English Radio. We were talking about the qualities and descriptions of mankind and al-insan in the Holy Quran. And I said, when you search the word al-insan in the Holy Quran, you encounter many negative descriptions and qualities. And we were trying to know the reason behind this. I know some of these descriptions come heavy for some people. In fact, the Holy Quran itself could be encountered in this way as a heavy word, and it describes itself. Quran describes itself as a heavy word. نَحْنُ نَزَلْنَا عَلَيْكَ قَوْلًا or إِنَّا نَزَلْنَا عَلَيْكَ قَوْلًا ثَقِيلًا. We have ascended down to you, descended down to you a heavy word. So part of this heaviness is the seriousness and directness and frankness of the Holy Quran when it comes to the description of humanity and human beings. And we should not get emotional. Some people get emotional and they think that it's a matter of, like, for example, suppressing humanity or something like that. But it's not the case. It's a reality that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wants, by bringing up those things, those negative qualities and descriptions, somehow inform us about the realities that we have to face when we deal with different situations, to know our capacities, to know our qualities, and to be careful not to fall down into the pitfalls in the journey that we have as a human being. So some people, as I said, they get emotional when they hear about those positive descriptions. Some they get emotional when they hear about those negative descriptions. And they end up being in emotional swings. Like either it's all good and nothing is problematic, as if nothing is wrong with me and I'm all happy, or I'm completely depressed and there's no possibility to talk about anything with me. So this is not the correct way to understand the approach of Quran in defining us for ourselves. Quran tries to tell us, okay, these are your possibilities, that the vicegerency of God on earth and the position that is upper than even angels, and also these are the pitfalls of being a human, and you should be careful about that. Nothing is emotional, nothing is bad in this. This is actually good that we encounter this in reality and accept the truth about ourselves and think about the best possible way to come up with some solutions and some way out from those problems and difficulties associated with being a human per se. So inshallah, in the coming episodes, we try to find out that, okay, now that we have a full description of human soul, that it has these possibilities, these virtues, these highest standards, and then at the same time, it had these shortcomings, these pitfalls, these problems. So what is the plan that Quran puts ahead and puts before us in order to achieve the perfection that Quran has for human being? This is very important because that plan is based on the capabilities and possibilities that we have as human beings. By considering different dimensions and aspects of the discussion, and also different stages that Quran has for that plan, for perfection, for humanity, I think we can at least know the prospect and the general outlook of what it looks like, a human being according to Quranic teachings. And then when we want to apply them, we can be more familiar with these concepts. Thank you very much. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. صلى الله على محمد صلى الله على النبي صلى الله على محمد وعلى آل النبي.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, Special Counsel Jack Smith has asked the federal judge overseeing the case against Donald Trump for his alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election to limit what the former president can say publicly about the case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special Counsel Jack Smith has asked the federal judge overseeing the case against Donald Trump for his alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 election to limit what the former president can say publicly about the case, accusing him of making inflammatory public statements aimed at influencing potential jurors and intimidating witnesses. In a 24-page court filing on Friday, 15th of September, Special Counsel Jack Smith and his prosecutors list a litany of posts by Donald Trump on his Truth Social platform since his indictment in the case in August. They say the former president has spread disparaging and inflammatory public posts on Truth Social on a near-daily basis regarding the citizens of the District of Columbia, the court, prosecutors and prospective witnesses. They allege that Trump knows he inspires others to penetrate threats and harassment against his targets. The government lawyers asked Judge Tanya Chutkan to impose a narrowly tailored order that would bar Donald Trump from making extrajudicial statements that present a serious and substantial danger of materially prejudicing the case. The defendant's repeated post that he cannot receive a fair trial from this court or from a jury of his peers in this district are substantially likely to undermine confidence in the justice system, affect the jury pool, or otherwise prejudice the due administration of justice, prosecutors wrote. His misleading statements regarding the special counsel's office and its investigation are designed to do the same, and his targeting of specific witnesses seeks to either bolster or impeach witnesses, not before this court, but instead in the court of public opinion before trial begins. The government proposed an order restricting statements regarding the identity, testimony, or credibility of prospective witnesses, and also statements about any party, any witness, attorney, or court personnel, or potential jurors that are disparaging and inflammatory or intimidating. Its court filing also said that such an order would not be intended to prohibit quotation or reference to public court records of the case or Donald Trump's proclamations of innocence. Government lawyers argued that Donald Trump has an established practice of issuing inflammatory public statements targeting at individuals or institutions that present an obstacle or challenge to him. They said that after the 2020 election, Trump focused on the election system and on election officials and others tasked with carrying out civic duties to implement fair elections. The government noted that those who were named by Donald Trump in his tweets were subject to threats and harassment. The court filing cited a few examples of this, noting that one individual told the House Select Committee that investigated the Capitol riot, "After the president tweeted at me by name, calling me out the way that he did, the threats became much more specific, much more graphic, and included not just me by name, but included members of my family by name, their ages, our address, pictures of our home, just every bit of detail that you could imagine. That was what changed with that tweet. The Trump campaign in a statement said the Department of Justice is corruptly and cynically continuing to attempt to deprive President Trump of his First Amendment rights. This is nothing more than blatant election interference because President Trump is by far the leading candidate in this race, the Trump campaign argued. The American people, the voters, see right through this unconstitutional charade and will send President Trump back to the White House. The government redacted the official's name in the court filing, but that quote came from the 6th of January House Select Committee testimony of former Philadelphia City Commissioner Al Schmidt in June of 2022. Donald Trump responded to the special counsel's request of the court on Truth Social platform. Trump said, "So I'm campaigning for president against an incompetent person who has weaponized the Department of Justice and FBI to go after his political opponent, and I'm not allowed to comment. They leak, they lie, they sue, and they won't allow me to speak. How else would I explain that Jack Smith is deranged or crooked Joe Biden is incompetent?" Donald Trump was indicted by a federal grand jury on 4 charges relating to his alleged attempts to reverse the 2020 election results and has pleaded not guilty. CNN Cable News Network has also covered the same story. Justice Department prosecutors want U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan to reel in Donald Trump's public statements in the federal 2020 election interference case against him, asking her to place a court order limiting what Donald Trump can say, according to a newly released court filing. The request for a limited gag order filed in recent days represents the most direct response from prosecutors with Special Counsel Jack Smith's office to the former president's public statements to date. The Justice Department said the order is needed to protect the integrity of his trial in March. Donald Trump has already been ordered not to intimidate potential witnesses or talk to them about the facts of this case. In making their argument, prosecutors pointed to false public statements that Donald Trump previously made around the 2020 vote to erode public faith in the administration of the election and intimidate individuals who refuted his lies. The defendant is now attempting to do the same thing in this criminal case to undermine confidence in a criminal justice system and prejudice the jury pool through disparaging remarks and inflammatory attacks on the citizens of this district. The court, the prosecutors, and prospective witnesses, prosecutors wrote in their court filing. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, an Obama appointee overseeing the criminal case in Washington, D.C., hasn't yet made a decision on the request. Trump blasted the special counsel's motion in a Truth Social post on Friday, calling Smith deranged and claiming that it was a move to silence the leading Republican candidate who could challenge President Joe Biden in the 2024 election. The former president doubled down on his attacks at an event in Washington, D.C. on Friday evening, 15th of September, accusing the special counsel of infringing on his rights. "Did you see today that deranged Jack Smith wants to take away my rights under the First Amendment, wants to take away my rights of speaking freely and openly," Donald Trump wrote. The prosecutor specifically asked for a court order limiting Trump's ability to speak out the identity, testimony, or credibility of prospective witnesses, and statements about any party, any witness, any attorney, court personnel, or potential jurors that are disparaging and inflammatory or intimidating. The court filing federal prosecutor cited Trump's recent criticism of former Vice President Mike Pence and Bill Barr, the former Attorney General under Trump, both of whom could be called as witnesses in the trial next year. Prosecutors also noted that Trump's previous social media posts against Chutkan, calling her a Trump-hating judge. Donald Trump, they noted, has called the special counsel prosecutors a team of thugs and has attacked Smith as deranged.
Face to face. Hello and welcome to Face to Face. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Today we'll be speaking to another individual who has a very, very special story. I think that definitely you will be interested in the story of Mr. Kazem Darobi. So stay with us and we'll be right back.
On September 17, 1992, in Berlin, an event took place that would forever change the life of Kazem Darobi and his family. At a restaurant called Mykonos, four people were shot and killed and another wounded. All of them were leaders of the Democratic Kurdish Movement of Iran. Darabi was a businessman who was studying at the university during that time. On that day, he would be a long way from Berlin, but because of a complex plan by anti-Iranian revolutionaries, Darabi would be blamed for this attack. But why? What was the goal of this, and how has this affected he and his family?
Well, thanks so much for being with us today. We have the special guest with me. I'm glad to welcome to the program Mr. Kazem Darabi. Thanks so much for being with us here.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Darabi, you have a very interesting story, unbelievable in so many ways when we think about it. Let's start off from the beginning. Can you tell me about when you were arrested?
In 1992, I was at my residential home in Berlin, accompanied by my spouse and children, when German police raided our house, arrested me, and took me away. The next morning, I was handed a detention order, which stated that I was a member of the Revolutionary Guards, Ministry of Intelligence, of Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as a member of the Union of Islamic Association of Students in Europe. Despite the lack of any investigations conducted into me, they arrested me and threw me into prison.
Why do you think you were arrested, though? And tell me, what were the charges at the end?
I was actively involved in religious and spiritual activities in Germany. Having resided in Berlin, Germany, for about 13 years before my arrest, I was a student, and I also engaged in business activities during my studies. Furthermore, we had cultural and religious activities with Lebanese, Palestinian, Turkish, Afghan, and Muslim centers from various places. For example, we organized processions on various occasions, such as Quds Day. We also held ceremonies for the anniversary of Imam Khomeini's demise, or the 22nd of Bahman. I was very active in all of these areas and gained recognition among Muslims as well as the German police. It seems that because they did not suspect anyone else and the main culprits had fled, they arrested me simply because I was Iranian. A court was formed, and I will explain the court proceedings to you later.
Well, let's talk about your imprisonment in general. And what was it like to be in solitary confinement?
When I was arrested and the detention order was issued, I was transferred to a temporary prison in Berlin. From the beginning of my arrest, I was thrown into solitary confinement. The cell was approximately 4 square meters, and I spent 5 years in solitary confinement. However, every few months, they would transfer me to a different cell. For example, if I was in Ward B, cell 256, and they would collect my belongings and move me to another cell. This had a significant psychological impact on me and caused distress. They transferred me to different cells about 20 times. The last time, I resisted fiercely and did not allow them to change my cell. This constant shifting had a heavy mental toll on me.
Who were the witnesses that they brought in to testify against you?
After about a year of being in solitary confinement, my trial began. Approximately 275 sessions were held to address this case. And during this time, 175 witnesses appeared. All of these witnesses were individuals who had witnessed nothing about me and had heard nothing. They were all opponents and critics of the Islamic Republic of Iran, including monarchists, mujahideen, Tudeh party members, Kumilas, Democrats, and all opponents of the Islamic Republic who lived abroad and wanted to exert pressure on the system and inflict harm. They would come and give testimony, and the most significant witness in these trials was Mr. Banisadr. They brought Abul Hassan Banisadr from France to Berlin, and in court, he explained that the Islamic Republic would assassinate its opposition abroad. However, he had no logical reason and presented no evidence to support his claims. Whenever my lawyer asked him a question, he would say, "Considering that if I speak, it is possible that they will realize where I obtained the information from, and it may pose a danger to other individuals." He used this as an excuse and provided no further information or credible documents. In Germany, they claim to be a rule of law, and they cannot convict anyone without evidence and documents. However, they did this in my case. They accepted all the false claims of Iranian opposition members living outside the country.
Let's talk about Yusuf Amin and who is he and the role that he played in your sentencing.
One of the reasons that led to my arrest was a personal confession made by a person named Yusuf Amin. Yusuf Amin was an individual who had confessed to being involved in that operation. As he had stated, he had been ordered to stand at the door of the restaurant while two individuals entered and one of them opened fire on the people inside and the other administered the coup de grace to them with a pistol. This was the entirety of Yusuf Amin's confession. Regarding myself, the only thing Yusuf Amin had said was that we used to live in Kazem Darabi's house before the operation, whereas I had left that house with my family 3 years prior and moved to another home, where I was not residing at all. After he confessed to this operation, I was arrested on October 8, 1992, based on his confession, and considering that they had linked me to various organizations in Iran, a sentence was issued against me. Prior to the start of the trial, Yusuf Amin wrote a letter to the chief judge, which still exists. In that letter, he wrote, "All the statements I made were false, and the police pressured me and said that if you don't speak, we won't release your brother, who was imprisoned at that time. They coerced me and gave me many promises that if you testify, we will set you free. And now, since they did not honor their promises, I confess here that I lied to the police. And all my statements, especially regarding Kazem Darabi, were false." Because he had mentioned that he knew Kazem Darabi, who was a religious man and the leader of Muslim guys, Yusuf Amin added that because Kazem Darabi was religious, he talked about him. Furthermore, since the police wanted a lot of information about him, I gave them information and exaggerated the details because I felt that's what the police wanted. So I also lied. This is the content of a letter that Yusuf Amin had written to the judge 1 year before my trial even began. This letter was also read aloud in court. After the trial began, the first person who said, "I want to speak," was Yusuf Amin. And he clearly stated in the presence of reporters and the whole world that all the information he had given to the interrogators was wrong and that he had lied, especially regarding Kazem Darabi. However, despite all this, Yusuf Amin's testimony in court was not accepted, and they said that the initial statement he had made was correct. For this reason, the officers who had sessions with Yusuf Amin and questioned him had to say in the presence of everyone that he lied. But they brought those officers to court, and those officers repeated his initial false statement. And in fact, they accepted the statements of the officers who had heard his private conversations. However, they did not accept the statements he made in court in front of everyone.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, who do you think wanted to use this situation, Mykonos situation, for their own benefit?
When the trial started, I realized that the lawyers of those who were against the Islamic Republic establishment and even the witnesses didn't care at all whether I or the other defendants would be convicted. Their only concern was to put pressure on Iran. For this reason, all the witnesses they had chosen were people against the Islamic Republic, meaning it was impossible for these individuals to speak in favor of the system. They used any means and any evidence they had, but none of them were credible. My lawyer told the chief judge that if we were allowed to have a camera there and document that kind of trial and interrogation, it would never yield positive results because the trial is entirely political. And different individuals, including even Germany and others, wanted to take advantage of the situation. Because they had individuals who were detained in Iran and had a death sentence, and they wanted to trade with them.
How did they want to incriminate the Islamic Republic in all of this?
Those who sought to exploit the court proceedings were individuals like Bani Sadr and Manoucher Ganji, who was the last minister of science during the time of the Shah, who had been invited as a witness. In other words, they had invited anyone opposing the Islamic Republic of Iran from all corners of the world and wanted to take advantage of this situation to undermine the system.
Was there any credible evidence given in the court at all?
In fact, they had no valid evidence. Even when they asked Bani Sadr where he obtained his information from, he said, "I cannot provide any document, nor can I disclose the source of this information."
Now, they had talked about the social and religious nature of your activities in Germany. You just talked about that. How did they want to connect that to the operation itself?
My religious activities were such that while I was a student, I also engaged in business activities and had connections with Muslims from other countries. We had an Islamic center. We had a mosque, and we were active in the mosque. We organized extensive demonstrations against Salman Rushdie and the chemical bombs that the Germans had provided to Saddam, which killed thousands of Kurds in Halabja and other places. Particularly, we held widespread protests against the parliament, which had provided Saddam with chemical weapons. They took advantage of this entire movement and targeted me as a Muslim who was engaged in religious activities, accusing me falsely.
So, talking about the court now, what was the final court order given to you? And how come you were freed prior to the end of your sentence?
After the trial and the testimony of various witnesses, and after 3 years and 275 court sessions, I was sentenced to life imprisonment, not as an operator, but as an instigator. In fact,
They gave me a life sentence and 10 years. But in Germany, there is a law that allows those sentenced to life imprisonment to have a court hearing after 13 years. They reduced my life sentence to 23.